Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Schon viel über Kryptowährungen gehört, aber noch keinen richtigen Zugang gefunden? Der Einstieg in Kryptowährungen muss nicht kompliziert sein. Mit Xtrackers ETCs kannst du kostengünstig in die Zukunft investieren. Einfach übers klassische Depot. Auf xtrackers.de findest du viel Wissenswertes zu dieser spannenden Anlageklasse. Nimm deine finanzielle Zukunft selbst in die Hand. Schritt für Schritt mit Xtrackers. Investitionen unterliegen Risiken. Dieser Beitrag ist eine Werbemitteilung der DWS International GmbH, Frankfurt.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Rebecca Kesby. And our main story today, which we will return to throughout the programme, is the coordinated attacks in Lebanon yesterday. Pagers used by the armed group Hezbollah were targeted, but it's impossible to know how many civilians are among the 3,000 or so injured. We do know that an 8-year-old girl and a boy of 11 have been killed, and that medical teams are struggling to cope with the number of casualties. Later in the programme, we'll look at how these attacks were possible, who made the pagers, and how were they modified into weapons. And obviously, we'll look at the diplomatic reaction to events and possible consequences. First, though, let's head straight to Lebanon, still in shock and some chaos following the attacks. First, the views from residents of the capital, Beirut.
What happened yesterday was a complete surprise. No one can believe it. It's unprecedented anywhere in the world. How could they blow up pagers people were using? It's unbelievable. There were explosions while people were at work, buying vegetables, walking down the street, or sitting in their cars.
We're all shocked by this attack. It's a tragedy what's happening to us and to all the entire population. May God protect Lebanon and every nation.
Well, Rania Abu Zaid is a Lebanon Australian journalist living in Beirut and joins us live from there now. Rania, thanks for coming on the programme. First of all, just update us on the mood in the capital. Are people feeling frightened today or angry?
Angry. There's a level of anger, and there is also a fear of what comes next. That's the big question now. Was this Israel's big hit, or was it the prelude to it? And how and when will Hezbollah respond and retaliate for this? They've already said that they will respond to this attack, and the question now is how and when. The party's leader, Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, is due to give a speech tomorrow afternoon. And certainly, you know, most eyes and ears here in Lebanon will be glued to televisions and radios to hear what he has to say.
Yeah, let's just take a moment to remind our listeners who Hezbollah are. It is an Iranian-backed military group, isn't it, with enormous power in Lebanon. What can you tell us about the grip they have there in the country? Are they more powerful than the government, for example?
They are part of the government. It is a paramilitary group. It is a political party with more than a dozen members of parliament. It has had ministers in the cabinet, in the Lebanese cabinet, for many, many years, including currently. So it is a key political player as well as a paramilitary group. And if you want to talk about why it has arms, Hezbollah was formed in 82 in response to the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. And that's why it is still armed, because parts of Lebanon are still under Israeli occupation. But yes, it's definitely a very powerful force. And, you know, for the past 11 months, it has been engaged in an escalating tit-for-tat battle along Lebanon's southern border and Israel's northern border region.
Amrania, you say that Hezbollah is promising retaliation. They're blaming Israel. We haven't had any comment yet from the Israeli government, and we have been trying to get an interview with them today or even a comment. So far, nothing. We'll keep chasing on that. But what can you tell us about what the Lebanese government has been saying in its response today?
Well, both the Lebanese government and Hezbollah were very quick to blame Israel for this attack. You know, Israel has carried out a number of targeted assassinations of Hezbollah members in these past 11 months and actually well before. So, you know, the fingers of blame were very quickly pointed at Israel.
Rania Abu Zaid, thank you so much for joining us live from the Lebanese capital, Beirut, there. Well, earlier this morning, health officials in Lebanon said that there are now about 200 casualties that are in a critical state, and 12 people are known to have been killed, including at least two children. Earlier, I spoke to Dr. Salah Zain-Adin, who's the chief medical officer at the American University of Beirut Medical Center.
We received a large number of injuries. We received around 200 injuries yesterday, 140 of which are still in hospital. Most of the injuries are related to eye injuries, facial injuries with nose, also lacerations, and fingers and waist and abdominal injuries.
And a word on the sort of casualties that are coming in, because, I mean, we know that the targets seem to have been Hezbollah fighters, but we've also heard that children have been affected. What kind of people are you treating?
The majority of our patients were actually middle-aged and young-aged men, but we also did receive a few pediatric, few children, and few women also injured. But the majority were men.
And can you tell us about the capacity of your health facility there to cope with this? Because obviously there are so many injuries, some of them quite serious. Are you coping okay?
We are coping okay, but we are stretched really too thin. We received around 200 injuries, as I said, within a matter of a couple of hours yesterday. Majority, as I said, were facial injuries and eye injuries and abdomen, who required really urgent attention and urgent care. 30 of which are still in the emergency department and the post-anesthesia units, the recovery units, because they do not have regular beds in hospital.
Okay.
Our operating rooms have been working nonstop. We have 12 operating rooms in continuous operation since the event, but we're able to keep up with the needs of our patients.
And you mentioned the abdominal injuries, and I guess this is because people would naturally wear a pager on their belts. What kind of surgeries have you been having to do, and any sort of amputations of hands and that sort of thing?
Yes, we had a lot of amputation of fingers, and unfortunately some lost their eyes, so have enucleation of eyes as well. And for the abdomen, it's an exploration of injury and repair of lacerations.
What can you tell us about the mood among your staff? Because we did see reports yesterday on social media that, in fact, some doctors had also been affected, because obviously lots of medics do wear pagers for professional reasons. Is that something you've come across?
We did not receive any medical personnel as a casualty.
Just to clarify, there were also claims that staff at your hospital, I think, had received a new batch of pagers in recent weeks. Is that?
We did not receive any new batch of pagers. We upgraded an already existing batch we had, and which has been for the past several months since April.
I understand.
We are still using them.
Sorry to push you on this, but what kind of upgrade? What would that involve?
Software upgrade and some hardware upgrade, but like antennas and stuff, but not for the actual devices that you carry.
Okay. And in terms of the healthcare, now that you're having to continue, and you mentioned there's still 30 in the emergency room, 140 still in your hospital, do you have everything you need, or are you still needing people to donate blood and
that sort of thing? We have enough blood donors, we have enough units. In terms of supplies, we had enough supplies to keep up with the needs, and we still have, you know, a good stock. As for the medical personnel, our people are working. We also had a couple of colleagues who practice outside Lebanon. They joined us today. They came in to help us operating. They're plastic surgeons and hand surgeons. So our operating capacity and personnel are working at capacity. However, we're keeping up with not in shortage.
And in terms of the moment this happened yesterday, I mean, that must have been quite a difficult set of circumstances with so many people, plus relatives rushing to the hospitals. And this was when it was unfolding. You wouldn't have known what had happened. What was that like?
It was really a great chaos. Our security teams have been superb, really. They blocked the entry and the exit so that we could function with the wounded. We were supported by the Lebanese National Army, who also helped us, you know, gatekeep the entrances in an efficient way. It was really very chaotic. We had hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of people around the hospital, but we were able to contain the masses.
Dr. Salah Zainuddin, their chief medical officer at the American University of Beirut Medical Center. Well, as I mentioned there, the Iranian-backed militant group Hezbollah did put out a statement blaming the Israeli government for the attacks shortly after they occurred, promising retaliation. Just to repeat again, we have asked the Israeli government for an interview, even a comment. They've repeatedly declined. We will keep trying, but we can cross now live to our correspondent in Jerusalem, Paul Adams. Paul, I mean, what's the reading of this there in Israel? Is silence an admission?
No, it's not an admission. And I can tell you there's no point you're trying to get any comments out of the Israeli government because they're not going to give it to you. They never would in a situation like this. So don't waste your time. Mm. Look, no one has any doubt about who did this. It clearly, Israel was the only power with the capability and the motive to take on Hezbollah in this spectacular fashion. So I don't think we even need to waste much time speculating on who did it. It was clearly Israel, and it is part of a covert effort that has taken many forms in the last few weeks. We had, obviously, the assassination of the senior Hezbollah leader, Fuad Shukr. Interestingly, he was targeted after he received a phone call telling him he should go to his apartment on the seventh floor of the building where he was in the southern suburbs of Beirut, only to be hit by a missile when he got there. So that was pretty sophisticated. We also had a very daring Israeli commando raid on an Iranian missile building facility in Syria about 10 days ago, in which Israeli troops were on the ground planting explosives inside this underground bunker and making off, we are told, with a certain amount of important intelligence as well. So in addition to the overt war, low-level overt war that Israel and Hezbollah have been waging for the better part of 11 months now, we have this covert war in which Israel is doing everything it can to degrade Hezbollah's capabilities.
And so what is the thinking as to why this is happening now?
Because over the past 11 months, as a result of this tit-for-tat fighting along Israel's northern border, that situation there remains incredibly volatile. Tens of thousands of civilians on both sides of the border have had to flee their homes. There is enormous pressure building here in Israel on the government to resolve this situation, to get to a situation where people can go back to their homes. And it was literally only two or three days ago that the government finally adopted, as one of its war aims for the war in Gaza, the return of civilians to those northern communities along the Lebanese border. So there has been a great deal of speculation that the Netanyahu government might be about to do something more significant than the airstrikes that it has been mounting relentlessly for the past year, possibly involving some kind of ground operation in southern Lebanon. We're not seeing any sign of a preparation for that. This attack yesterday might, in other circumstances, have been seen as perhaps laying the groundwork for such an operation, because obviously, in addition to mutilating thousands of Hezbollah fighters, it also severely damaged their communications infrastructure as well. Mm. But we've not seen any sign that that is about to happen.
Okay, for the moment, thank you so much for joining us live there. That's our correspondent in Jerusalem, Paul Adams. Coming up later on the programme, we'll be hearing from the US state of Oregon and the debate there around decriminalising hard drugs such as fentanyl and recriminalising them.
See, the problem with the fentanyl to me was I couldn't go maybe 2 hours without, and I'd have to smoke it again or get deathly sick.
Were you worried about overdosing?
No. No, I wasn't worried about that. It happened once, but no, it didn't change anything. What you worry about is running out.
More on that from James Menendez in Oregon in about 30 minutes or so. And our top headline this hour, Iran has accused Israel of murder after the mass detonation of handheld pagers in Lebanon. Hezbollah fighters and the Iranian ambassador to Beirut were among the targets of an attack that's been described as breathtaking. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Well, following that attack yesterday, simultaneous attacks on pager devices in Lebanon thought to be targeting Hezbollah fighters, there's been a furious response elsewhere in the region. Iran has followed Hezbollah in blaming Israel for the attacks. The Iranian ambassador, as we heard there, was one of those injured, though not seriously. Iran has accused Israel of, quote, mass murder. Well, the Jordanian foreign minister, Ayman al-Safa, Fadi accused Israel of pushing the region to the abyss of war. And the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, is in the Egyptian capital, Cairo, today. He gave this response to reporters.
The United States did not know about, nor was it involved in, these incidents. And we're still gathering the information and gathering the facts. Broadly speaking, we've been very clear, and we remain very clear, about the importance of all parties avoiding any steps that could further escalate the conflict that we're trying to resolve in Gaza, to see it spread to other fronts. It's clearly not in the interest of anyone involved to see that happen.
And that was Antony Blinken speaking a couple of hours ago. Well, we're joined now live by Professor Lina Khatib, who's an associate fellow at the Independent Policy Institute, Chatham House. Lina, you study the movements of Hezbollah closely. How is the group likely to have been affected by yesterday's attacks?
This would have been a complete blow to Hezbollah's morale. Because this is something that Hezbollah was simply not prepared for. Hezbollah is used to military action, not a security breach of this scale. Never in the history of Hezbollah has the group faced an infiltration of its communications network as well as its supply chain at this level. So this is something that is stunning for Hezbollah, that will virtually paralyze Hezbollah in terms of what it can do to maneuver against Israel.
Well, yes, maybe you can explain why they'd been using pagers as opposed to other communication like maybe radio or mobile phones over the past few months and years.
Yes, they had been using mobile phones, but Israel managed to use those mobile phones to track the movements of Hezbollah operatives. And these mobile phones basically ended up exposing these operatives to Israeli strikes, and hundreds, literally hundreds of Hezbollah commanders and officers have been assassinated in targeted killings by Israel since last October, partly as a result of this infiltration. And therefore, the Secretary General of Hezbollah made a public plea to Hezbollah's members not to use mobile phones anymore. And so they shifted to pagers, thinking these would not be intercepted and would be safer.
And Lina, you said that they've been saying that they're going to retaliate, but that their capability to do that may be compromised now because of what happened yesterday. They have been firing rockets over the border. A number of Israeli soldiers have been killed over the past few months, and indeed civilians as well. What could be their response to this attack?
I mean, they are probably now really wondering what to do next, because they have been launching rockets on Israel for several months now. Israel has not stopped its own counterattacks on Hezbollah, including yesterday and today. So even though this operation happened with the pagers, the bombing by Israel in southern Lebanon has not stopped. And so for Hezbollah, any retaliation needs to go beyond the rocket exchange with Israel. And this is where the real dilemma lies for Israel, for Hezbollah, because any such military planning will necessarily mean using communication tools of some sort. And the communication tools have now been shown to have been exposed. And so I think, you know, what we can expect next is definitely a lot of angry rhetoric by Hezbollah. But when it comes to escalation, I don't think this is likely, at least in the short term.
Okay, good to speak to you. Thanks so much for joining us live. That's Professor Lina Khatib there, Associate Fellow at Chatham House. Now, let's move on briefly to some other news now. Now, when we think about climate change, we normally think about immediate impacts like heat waves, droughts, floods. But in fragile nations, climate change can even have more damage than that. Some analysts describe it as a chaos multiplier. It can worsen existing conflicts by intensifying the competition for scarce resources. So what can be done to lift vulnerable nations out of this cycle of misery? Our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt, has been to the war-torn East African nation of Somalia to find out.
The country has just experienced its worst drought for 40 years, an event scientists reckon was made 100 times more likely by human-caused climate change. It left people literally fighting for access to water and to pasture, says Sheikh Don Ismail, a local farmer.
There's no respect if you don't have a gun. The herders who lead their animals into the farm stay back when they see my gun. They get scared of you.
For the last 30 years, Somalia has been experiencing a brutal Islamist insurgency, a civil war, and a whole series of regional and clan conflicts. It means local disputes like these can easily spiral into full-blown battles. And it is not just drought. Somalia has experienced terrible floods as well. The most vulnerable bear the brunt. Mothers bring their babies into a Red Cross hunger clinic in a port town in the south of Somalia. The UN estimates 1.5 million children under the age of 5 are acutely malnourished. This combination of climate change and conflict has driven 4 million Somalis, a fifth of the population, into vast makeshift refugee camps. There's little international help. People live in huts made from rubbish they've scavenged. They have to pay rent as well as for their food and water. It means there is a huge reservoir of people desperate for paid work. Like many men in the camps, Alima Ali Mohammed's husband and 4 of her sons have taken up the only opportunity open to them as fighters in the local militia.
They are rural people with no skills, so the only work they could get was in the army. They were desperate, and when you are without food long enough and your children are looking at you, you will do anything.
And it's not like climate change is the Somali people's fault. The entire country has emitted roughly as much carbon dioxide from fossil fuels since the 50s as the US has in the last 3 days. Yep, 3 days. But Somalia is taking action. We visited a power station moving over to wind and solar power and training up a new generation of renewable energy engineers. I met entrepreneurs setting up new businesses, including a refugee woman who set up her own cafe in the camp. It is why Abdi Hakim Anti, the climate advisor to the Somali PM, is surprisingly optimistic.
Now, I don't subscribe to the notion that Somalia is unfixable. I think it's fixable, and it's showing a significant progress on pretty much every front that you can look into.
Justin Rowlatt with that report there from Somalia.
Schon viel über Kryptowährungen gehört, aber noch keinen richtigen Zugang gefunden? Der Einstieg in Kryptowährungen muss nicht kompliziert sein. Mit Xtrackers ETCs kannst du kostengünstig in die Zukunft investieren. Einfach übers klassische Depot. Auf xtrackers.de findest du viel Wissenswertes zu dieser spannenden Anlageklasse. Nimm deine finanzielle Zukunft selbst in die Hand. Schritt für Schritt mit Xtrackers. Investitionen unterliegen Risiken. Dieser Beitrag ist eine Werbemitteilung der DWS International GmbH, Frankfurt.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. In a few minutes, we'll have more on those attacks in Lebanon against Hezbollah. Our reporter is at a factory in Hungary associated with the compromised pagers. But first, for decades, politics in Sri Lanka has been dominated by one family, the Rajapaksas. But their reputation was ruined by the country's economic collapse in 2022, a result of decades of financial mismanagement by governments in which they played leading parts. Well, there are presidential elections on Saturday, and some are hopeful that this could be the beginning of a new era. The BBC's South Asia correspondent Samira Hussain reports from Sri Lanka.
The Rajapaksas have dominated Sri Lankan politics for decades. Namal Rajapaksa is the latest from the political dynasty to enter the presidential race. His family has a long history in Sri Lanka, most notably for sinking the island nation into a crushing economic crisis.
Massive amount of excitement as Namal Rajapaksa takes the stage at this political rally. Hundreds have come to listen to him speak. Now, although the Rajapaksa name comes with a lot of political baggage, he believes that he can overcome some of that legacy.
His father and his uncle, both forced out of office, but Namal Rajapaksa says he can be somebody new.
The Rajapaksas are blamed for Sri Lanka's economic woes. Why do you think you should run?
Well, see, it's up to the people to decide, and we know our hands are clean. We know we haven't done anything wrong to the people or to this country. So we are willing to face the people and the public. So let the public decide as to what they want to vote for.
2 years ago, there was a massive uprising against severe food shortages and skyrocketing inflation, a result of decades of financial mismanagement by the Rajapaksas. Furious protesters defying curfews, phenomenal scenes of people storming the presidential palace. We've come 2 hours outside Colombo to a political rally, and it's held by Anura Kumara Dissanayake. Now, he is running, saying that he's the representative for the working class. And there's quite a lot of people here. Several thousand have come out to listen to him speak. There's music. There are pink flags everywhere, people wearing bright pink hats. I see a woman in front of me actually wearing a bright pink dress that matches his political colors.
Dissanayake has become an unlikely frontrunner. Also a strong contender, Sajid Premadasa, leader of the opposition. There are a total of 38 candidates in these elections, including the current president, Ranil Wickremesinghe. Whoever becomes the next president of Sri Lanka has got big problems to solve, not just the economy, but rebuilding the trust of the people too.
And that was our South Asia correspondent Samira Hussain with that report from Sri Lanka ahead of elections this weekend. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC. I'm Rebecca Kesby. More now on our top story, the simultaneous exploding pager devices in Lebanon. There were also a small number in Syria. Officials in Beirut say that around 3,000 people have been injured, 200 or so remain in a critical condition, and 12 people have been killed, we understand, including two children. It was clearly a coordinated attack designed to cause injury and chaos, but it's never been attempted before, certainly not on this scale. So how did whoever did this pull it off? The pagers themselves carried the label of a Taiwanese company, Gold Apollo. Their offices in Taipei have been raided by police today. The company said they were not involved in the manufacturing of the devices and that they may have been made by a Hungarian firm. And we can cross live now to Hungary and our correspondent there, Nick Thorpe. I believe, Nick, you're at the factory of this Hungarian firm.
Well, actually, I'm outside the offices of the Hungarian firm. There's no sign that this is a factory or any kind of manufacturing base at all. It's a nondescript two-storey building. It's almost like a residential house. The only sign of BAC Consulting, the company which has been named by the Taiwanese company, by Gold Apollo as the manufacturer, is a single piece of paper just inside the front window there behind the gate. And there, BAC Consulting is the fourth name down among 13 or 14 companies there. So we've been speaking also, or trying to speak to people in the building all day. We understand there are people there because what we believe were plainclothes police went in this morning, but no one actually has been able to give us any further information. One person did say that no one seems to work here at all, that most people who are registered here seem to work from home.
And Nick, we heard there that the Taiwanese authorities have raided Gold Apollo in Taipei. Any activity there from the authorities in Hungary, and would they have an interest in exploring that avenue there?
Well, it's interesting, the two gentlemen who came this morning that we believe were probably plainclothes policemen, they, when they rang the bell, they were the only people that were actually let into the building. But as I say, other people, other companies are registered at the same address. No sign of any official police presence. And my attempts to reach the Hungarian Prime Minister's office, and I directly approached the Hungarian Foreign Minister, Peter Szijjártó, for comment, but no response from either so far. So a lot of silence from the government side, and also silence from the company, which seems to, whether, you know, it actually exists, right, or if this was some kind of front for it.
Well, quite. So it doesn't look as if there's any factory nearby, and we don't know that there are any others linked to it elsewhere in the country.
That's right. You know, Hungary is, you know, famous as a centre of electronics. I've reached out this afternoon, you know, once we first got the information, to other electronics companies. But so far, those that I've managed to speak to say they have no knowledge of BAC Consulting. Those I've spoken to so far say they have no knowledge at all of this particular company, you know, if it exists, if it has an economic activity.
Okay, Nick Thorpe there live in Hungary. Thanks very much for the latest on that. Well, let's speak now to David Hambling, who's a military technology journalist and author based in South London. Now, David, this is very intriguing, this story. These pagers are a pretty old-fashioned technology, aren't they? What would have had to have happened to them to turn them into this kind of weapon?
Well, initially there was speculation that what was going on was thermal runaway. That's what happens with certain types of lithium-ion battery. When they start to overheat, they go into a feedback and they continue heating up until the chemicals inside the battery actually break down. They produce gases which are flammable, and you can get a fire or even an explosion. And we saw that happening with a batch of Galaxy phones in 2016. So this is something that can happen with badly designed batteries. But there is no indication that that happened here, because that would, you'd basically get a thermal effect, a fire, whereas what we're seeing is definitely a blast. Well, this is an explosive weapon.
Well, and also it's the simultaneous nature of it too, isn't it? Because if it was kind of deterioration of the battery, wouldn't that, some pages might go off at different times? These all went off at the same time.
Yeah, clearly it was triggered by something. And obviously it being pages, we know with near certainty it will have been triggered by a particular signal. signal that had been sent to those pages that they will have a circuit in there which is designed to go off when it gets that particular signal. But as I say, it won't just have been the battery that was overloading. There will have been some explosive material inside the casing. And it's clearly a very small amount, but sufficient given the design.
Okay.
Because what you're talking about is just a few grams of explosive.
So on the detonation then, and sorry to kind of get forensic on this, and obviously we're not trying to give anybody hints on how to make this kind of thing, but scientifically it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because the detonation of them would have to be simultaneous, and it was, but we do know that a number of them didn't go off and they're being looked into. Do we know whether there was also that maybe the person who had the pager also had to be involved, maybe press a button or respond to the text?
From the reports we've seen so far and from the injuries, it sounds like the signal was sent that caused the pager to give a signal and an error message. So the user would have taken the pager and pressed a button to clear the error message while looking at it. And apparently about 60% of the people injured have serious facial injuries. So it looks like there would have been some explosives probably just behind the display. And that would ensure that the glass or plastic display would have been sprayed as shrapnel into the person's face. So I think we're seeing a lot of blinding injuries. It's a very nasty and efficient way of using a very small explosion to cause maximum damage.
Well, David, I mean, there are implications of this. We've talked about who might be responsible, lots of people pointing fingers at Israel. But, I mean, isn't there an implication that this kind of technology could be used by another group?
It could be, but this is this attack does, I would say, have the hallmarks of the Israeli intelligence services over it. In 1996, they famously used a exploding mobile phone to assassinate a Hamas bomb maker. So this is the kind of thing they would do. But also, it's clearly a very large-scale operation. They either interfered with a shipment of several thousand pages, or they were actually involved in the manufacturing. This is definitely a large state-level operation going on. This is not something that could have been done by a small group. And there are very few intelligence agencies in the world with the kind of resource to do this competently and reliably.
David Hambling, thanks so much for joining us live there. So who was responsible for these attacks? Which organisation, as David was saying there, has the ability to reach to tamper with devices manufactured possibly by a Hungarian firm and distributed in Lebanon? Who would know to whom the pages were being given? And who would have the motivation to want to stage such an attack given the risks of retaliation? Well, Iran, Hezbollah and others are all pointing the finger at Israel. Again, Israel hasn't commented so far, but earlier I spoke to Anshel Pfeffer. He's Israel correspondent for The Economist magazine and author of a biography on Benjamin Netanyahu. So what's his view? Could Israel have done this?
Israel allegedly has the sophisticated technology, the penetration of its intelligence services into Lebanon and Hezbollah. And Israel certainly has the motivation after 11 months of Hezbollah firing rockets at Israel's northern communities. So the answer to that would probably be yes.
And if Israel is responsible, what would be the strategic thinking, the purpose of these attacks, and why now?
Well, the timing really is the big question. Now, this kind of an operation could have been a prelude to a bigger military operation by putting thousands of Hezbollah military operatives in hospital and disrupting their communications networks. It would be a very useful way to start a military campaign. But as we've seen so far, there hasn't been a military campaign. So that doesn't seem to have been the objective. From what I understand from speaking to people here in Jerusalem, the main idea is to try and to put a warning to Hezbollah, to its leader, Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah. These are the kind of prices that Hezbollah would have to pay if there's a war. This is how Israel can reach into Lebanon and locate the organization's members And if this situation on Israel's northern border with Hezbollah firing rockets every day and this tit-for-tat war doesn't scale down, then it does seem that Israel's threatening Hezbollah to go much further.
I mean, it's certainly an audacious attack, isn't it? Months in the planning. And whoever did it is sending a clear message, as you say there. But there will be criticism on the ethics of this kind of attack, because you can't know that it's only Hezbollah fighters that will be affected. And we've already heard that some children have been killed. I mean, people will say this is indiscriminate, won't they, that it's irresponsible?
But that's one way of looking. The other way of looking at it is that we've seen in Gaza the immense suffering of civilians when Israel tries to attack Hamas headquarters there. An Israeli official, if that's what you were interviewing now, would say, well, this is exact opposite. This is an operation which tries as much as possible to focus on these individual Hezbollah military officials. This is a small bomb going off in a device held by one of these people. The reason that they have these pages is they're part of the Hezbollah hierarchy. So, yes, in every kind of operation like this, there is a risk of hurting civilians and people who are not involved. But I think the argument here would be that this is as targeted as possible as you can have.
Will this be the spark that makes the conflict escalate further?
I think that in this case it won't, because the fact that, A, we've seen that Israel hasn't followed up with a military campaign. From Hezbollah's side, they obviously would like to respond to this, but they're now at a disadvantage. If they launch a wider war than the one they've already been carrying out for the past 11 months, they're at a tactical disadvantage now. So I think in this case, this isn't an operation which pushes us further towards an all-out war, and it's more of a warning of what could happen if such a war were to take place.
But Hezbollah is backed by the Iranians. Will they not feel that they would respond in some way?
Basically, Hezbollah was formed by the Iranians 40 years ago. The Iranians have been using groups like that, proxies, in the region for so long, because I think the Iranians still have their own massive trauma from the 1980s, from the Iran-Iraq war, when they lost a million of their people, that they don't want to see this coming to their doorsteps, which is why they've used the proxies. And I think Iran will be looking at this and saying, OK, how do we limit this damage? How do we contain this so it won't reach us?
How do you anticipate Washington to be responding to this today?
The Biden administration, their main concern is not to see a bigger war taking place from now on until the election, certainly. They'll be looking to see if they can contain this event. Israel needed to do something, I think, against Hezbollah after 11 months of this war. And if the alternatives are some kind of semi-deniable sabotage like we saw yesterday, or a bigger military offensive, I think they prefer this than a military offensive. You know, the moment the tanks start rolling into Lebanon, it'll be much, much harder to stop. So I'm not certain that the Americans don't see this as the lesser of evils.
Anshel Pfeffer, their Israel correspondent for The Economist. And there are more details on this story on the BBC News live page. There you can follow the latest on the investigation. You're listening to NewsHour Live from the BBC with me, Rebecca Kesby. And we can head to the States now, because at the end of 2020, people in the US West Coast state of Oregon voted for a different approach to dealing with the burgeoning drug abuse. 58% gave their backing to a new law decriminalising the possession of a small amount of hard drugs, things like fentanyl, heroin, methamphetamine and cocaine. Instead of a conviction, users were given a fine, a bit like a speeding ticket, which they could get out of if they went to rehab. But nearly 4 years on, that experiment has just come to an end. From the beginning of this month, possession is once again a crime. That's after a public outcry against the number of people openly taking drugs, the numbers living on the streets, and the influx of people coming to Portland so that they could take drugs. NewsHour's James Menendez has this report.
A fentanyl strong. You know, and that was just the new thing. It grasped you and didn't want to let go. And I tried to get off of it once myself. Well, I couldn't.
Bill, who's originally from Alaska, tells me he's been a drug addict most of his life. He's 62, but looks older, with a nervous gaze that occasionally breaks into a wry, crinkled smile. Like when he tells me that he came to Oregon because a friend said it was easy to score drugs, in particular fentanyl, coming up the west coast from Mexico. His friend was right. It was easy, and that sent Bill hurtling into the abyss.
See, the problem with the fentanyl, to me, was I couldn't go maybe 2 hours without, and I'd have to smoke it again, or get deathly sick.
Were you worried about overdosing?
No. No, I wasn't worried about that. It happened once, but no, it didn't change anything. What you worry about is running out.
We've come to downtown Portland now. We're quite near one of the main highways. We're at an intersection, and I've come to talk to Max Williams, who was heavily involved in the campaign to recriminalise the possession of hard drugs. What was your problem with the moves to decriminalise hard drugs? Where did it go wrong?
I think it opened up a considerable more amount of open-air drug use. The consequences that the provisions had allowed for a $100 ticket to be written by law enforcement, but there was zero enforcement. And as a result, we saw increasing amounts of overdoses, increased retail crime, and violent crime, and people becoming increasingly concerned about an almost dystopian feel to Portland's downtown.
When we were walking up here, we saw three people openly doing drugs. This is a problem that's going to take a while to fix, isn't it? It's not going to be an overnight change.
I do think collectively, if you were to ask most people in and around the Portland area, they would say things are trending in the right direction, but it's not going to be an overnight success.
Welcome in. This facility here exists exclusively for individuals that require 24/7, 365 medical monitoring. Our staff of about
one of the benefits of the Portland experiment, known as Measure 110, was more funding for the treatment of addiction, paid for in a neat twist out of the taxes on sales of marijuana, which is legal in the state of Oregon. That money helped set up this detox facility in the city, run by a charity called Recovery Works Northwest. Joe Bazeghi is its director of engagement. Can I ask you this? I mean, there is have been an argument that decriminalisation caused more overdoses in Portland. Your best place to answer whether that's true or not, is
yes.
It?
No, it's not true. What is true is that the replacement of our heroin supply with illicitly manufactured fentanyl, 50 times as strong, has spiraled our overdose death rates. Measure 110 was passed in November of 2020 and implemented in February of 21. We saw a 70% increase in overdose deaths in Oregon in 2020 before the law was implemented.
What do you make of the fact that it's been recriminalized? What do you think the impact will be? I mean, are you unhappy that that step has been taken place? What do you make of it?
People are less likely to engage with treatment if they first have to admit to a crime in order to enter treatment. So people are afraid because criminality is associated with their health condition.
And supporters of decriminalization insist that the basic idea was sound. Spend less on sending addicts to prison and spend more on rehabilitation. The problem, they say, was both the deluge of fentanyl on the streets and also a failure of implementation. In their encounters with police, too few addicts were directed towards treatment. No one paid the fine. And yet hardly anyone pursued the alternative, a call to the special hotline that was set up to get people into rehab. Add to that the ravages of COVID.
I'm Tara Hurst. I'm the executive director of the Health Justice Recovery Alliance. I think the pandemic was really the biggest culprit. Our state was facing some of the most challenging times in at least our generation. How to get vaccines, lockdown, money out the door for people struggling. And so nothing got implemented when it came to law enforcement. They weren't brought in as partners. They weren't brought in to say, okay, here are all the services that we're standing up.
Are the resources there? Were they there? Are they still there now to actually get all the people that you see who clearly need help to get them into treatment?
No. And we're going to lose resources because now we are putting our resources back into law enforcement, which is not the right solution for people who are struggling with an illness.
Unsurprisingly, perhaps, the police see it differently. Sergeant Aaron Schmautz is head of the Portland Police Association, which represents rank-and-file officers. He believes a lack of cooperation undermined the experiment with decriminalisation, born out of a wider distrust of the police.
The bill was set up to be a negative tension point between law enforcement and treatment providers. It was to insert treatment providers in and pull law enforcement out, but it left a huge vacuum. Now, over a couple years, the conversation then pivoted to a health approach around addiction. I agree with that, but the way that the law was written prevented us from engaging in interdiction, both with users, but more importantly, with dealers.
Caught in the middle of all these arguments, people like Bill, who was brought back from the brink by Recovery Works. Others weren't so lucky. Last year in Oregon, nearly 1,400 people died from an opioid overdose, a fivefold increase since 2019.
And how are you feeling now?
Oh, it's way better to be freed up to where I don't have to find a place to hide and smoke, you know. That's pretty good.
So, is it fair to say that this place saved your life?
Oh, that's way fair. Yeah.
And that was Bill, a former fentanyl addict, ending that report by NewsHour's own James Menendez there in Portland, Oregon. And that's it for this edition of NewsHour. Don't forget, for more information on the Lebanon story, do go to the BBC Live website. But from all of us here, thanks for listening.
Schon viel über Kryptowährungen gehört, aber noch keinen richtigen Zugang gefunden? Der Einstieg in Kryptowährungen muss nicht kompliziert sein. Mit Xtrackers ETCs kannst du kostengünstig in die Zukunft investieren. Einfach übers klassische Depot. Auf xtrackers.de findest du viel Wissenswertes zu dieser spannenden Anlageklasse. Nimm deine finanzielle Zukunft selbst in die Hand. Schritt für Schritt mit Xtrackers. Investitionen unterliegen Risiken. Dieser Beitrag ist eine Werbemitteilung der DWS International GmbH, Frankfurt.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.